The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, February 16th, 2018. It was a surprise big day from special counsel Robert Mueller, who handed up an indictment of 13 Russian individuals and a few companies for a troll farming scheme designed to interfere with and influence the U.S. 2016 election. In addition, he announced a plea with a separate individual for identity fraud in a fashion that is probably related to the larger indictment. I have here on a recorded conference line David Kress, former Assistant Attorney General for National Security, and in the Jungle Studio, Matt Tate, former GCHQ hacker. And we will be joined shortly on the line by Paul Rosenzweig, who was Associate Independent Counsel under Ken Starr. Gentlemen, we have a great deal to talk about. First of all, impressions of the indictment. David, get us started. What do you think?
Well, I think that the narrative described in the indictment was, in one sense, entirely foreseeable, given everything that we already knew. And nevertheless, at least for me, it was still bracing or even stunning to see it laid out in black and white in such intense and clinical prosecutorial detail. So even if you knew something like this was true or was coming out, I still was really taken aback by it when I read through the document.
Okay, so help me with that, because I had very much the same reaction. And then I was trying to justify it to myself, and I said, well, hang on a sec. The intelligence community has publicly taken the position since more than a year ago that the Russians interfered in the U.S. election, and they've stated that with high confidence, which is intelligence community speak for it's true. Every head of every U.S. intelligence agency, even in the face of the president's apparent doubts, has reiterated that claim whenever asked. And so what is actually new here other than now the Justice Department saying it in public?
Well, I think it's the level of detail, precision, the narrative arc. The document produced, the unclassified document at least, produced by the intelligence community was a very fine example of the kind of product that they can produce. And it is very, very, you know, almost sterile in its attempt to be objective. This is a speaking indictment. This is a narrative that tells a story with dates and names and details and lots of precision around exactly what happened. So you learn about Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and you learn about PayPal. And yes, some of the banks and some of the U.S. person victims are identified either generically or by their initials. But there's just lots of names, dates, places, and other details in this document. In a way, it's the follow-up document to the original intelligence community assessment that a different president might have ordered. And or I think also an example of the kind of information that prosecutors with the tools that they have can gather. And so, yes, again, we probably aren't that surprised having read the U.S. intelligence community assessment, but this has really got a lot of rich nuance and detail that tells the story in a much more compelling way, at least for me.
Okay, so Matt, first of all, your reaction, but secondly, let's pick up where David just left off. Tells the story. What is the story this document is and isn't telling?
Sure. So very superficially, it's talking about this company called the Internet Research Agency, which was this troll farm that, you know, existed in St. Petersburg and was responsible for things like the Tennessee GOP Twitter account, which had over 100,000 followers, that was purchasing thousands of dollars of advertising, which, you know, we already knew that this had been reported in the press before. But what's really interesting here is the amount of additional information that sort of links this in with behaviors that are really very unlike what you would expect an ordinary company to be doing. You know, this is a company that is sending people out to the United States in 2014, ostensibly to, you know, be here on vacation visas, who are then conducting intelligence for intelligence reports inside the United States and then being reimbursed for those expenses when they go back home. You see that they're doing things like they're setting up bank accounts under sort of deceased people's names, you know, doing direct bank fraud, that they're setting up VPNs inside the United States in order to pretend that they're connecting to all these websites from the United States. So they're doing an awful lot of things here, which sort of sets them apart from being, you know, this troll farm that's just ordinarily in the private sector. This is very much more clearly an operation that's doing things that look much more like what an intelligence agency would be doing. And one of the other things that's really interesting to me is the timeline that's involved. We see, for instance, that this operation starts in early 2014, which is about the same time that the Ukrainian Maidan is taking place. We start to see that this is a very sort of methodical process, that they're spending a long time doing research. You know, they're trying to work out what the US elections are going to look like, that they're planning to interfere with the 2016 election from the middle of 2014. And we start to see, for instance, some linkovers between the DNC hack and the John Podesta hack, although it's never actually explicitly mentioned in this indictment. We see that the first time where they're starting to do actual bank fraud, they're setting up fake bank accounts, is the day before the Guccifer 2 account, or 2 days before the Guccifer 2 account appears. It's the day before the Washington Post article that says that the DNC had been hacked by Russians. So we're starting to see that there's a lot of linking here between the Internet Research Agency and a lot of these other things that we know very strongly are related to the Russian government.
Okay, let's talk about what's not in this indictment, which President Trump made a big deal of. And actually, Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General and Acting Attorney General for purposes of L'Affaire Russe, also made a big deal of, which is any allegation that any U.S. person or U.S. national, including those named from the Trump campaign as having been contacted by and manipulated by this troll farming operation, did anything wrong. So Trump claims a vindication from this on collusion grounds. David, what do you think? Is this a situation where if Mueller had the goods on collusion, these people would have been accused in the indictment, or is this situation where this is the document where you establish the predicate, that is, that there was an interference, and here's what it looked like, and any allegations of collusion that maybe you are or maybe you're not going to make, you would really expect to be in a different document at a different time?
Yeah, I think the latter, Ben. I can understand why President Trump would have said or been advised to say what he said, to note what isn't here rather than what is here. But I think what is here is without prejudice of more to come. It certainly is true. I mean, just to be clear, this document is about this Russian covert action or influence campaign. In fact, even ties to the Russian government, I think, only are stated in about one sentence, although there's obviously something lurking behind all that. And it is true, I think, that all the U.S. persons mentioned in it are either unwitting or victims. But this may very well be a piece of a larger puzzle with other pieces to come later. So if I were the president, I would not be, or the president's lawyers, I would not be highly confident that that Mueller has shot his wad and this is it. I think there's more to come.
So this is not the first time the Justice Department has indicted people that from foreign countries for U.S. hacks that it's likely never to get its hands on, and are benefiting from the protection of the regimes for which these, the benefit of which these hacks were done. The ugly gorilla China hack, China indictment is the sort of most prominent example of that. But I'm interested, how much of this do you think is symbolic and how much of it has practical consequences, and what are the practical consequences other than that these people won't be able to go to countries where an Interpol red notice will have effect with respect to the U.S.?
Well, from my point of view, this can be seen in at least three lights. One, definitely for these people, it's going to limit their travel, and we have a long memory and a long arm, and if we do ever get our hands on them, then that'll have consequences for them. Number two, I think it's, as you said, Ben, maybe a predicate or an important piece in the larger mosaic that Mueller is assembling here. I don't think of Bob Mueller as the kind of guy who sends signals in that sense. He's not a symbolic gesture sort of a man, in my assessment. But, you know, it also does, or at least can be seen by us as part of that continuing name and shame campaign that you were talking about with the PLA indictments of China a while back. I mean, broadly speaking, we have developed a little bit of a virus here as an open democracy with free information flow. And we're seeing what the Russians did here, I think, as part of that virus. We've got to develop a better immune system culturally and maybe legally to deal with it. And this indictment and the publicity around this indictment, the way we name and shame, may be part of a developing immune system to this sort of conduct.
Matt, what do you think of that? Is this a situation where an indictment can plausibly play a kind of, I guess, a warning role to the public? Don't believe everything you read on a Twitter feed that purports to be from the Tennessee GOP, that it is the kind of building of an immune system? Or is this really a more retroactive accountability for what was happened? Or is it both?
I think it's pretty difficult to work out because this is being done through the special counsel's office rather than being done through the ordinary Department of Justice. So it's a little bit difficult to assume that the sort of ordinary signaling of the Department of Justice is necessarily being what we're seeing here. What we do know, of course, is that these people then can't leave the Russia and its surrounding territories. One of the things that's very interesting is that the guy that funds this is a guy called Yevgeny Prigozhin. I'm sure I've pronounced his name wrong, is a billionaire friend of Vladimir Putin. So this is someone that we know from before. I think he's already on the sanctions list. But what this does is this ties this a little bit closer to this is Vladimir Putin and his friends. And it's also telling us this was a directed effort. And that's something that's, very important to realize that this wasn't some mom and pop store. This wasn't some, some tiny operation with a couple of Twitter accounts. This was a directed effort where they had a year planning stage where, you know, they did this systematically. And I think that that's actually something that's really important for Robert Mueller to be able to make the case that this wasn't something trivial, that this was a real campaign. And actually that justifies a lot of his investigation.
So we are joined on the line now by Paul Rosenzweig, who knows something about special counsel investigations, having served in one. Paul, welcome to the Lawfare Podcast Special Emergency Edition.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
What does this indictment say to you about the state of the special counsel's investigation? You know, Ty Cobb has spent most of the last several months saying it's winding down. He's getting ready to, clear the president, and he seems to have really reassured President Trump about where the special counsel's investigation is going. When you look at this indictment, what does it say to you about where we should understand Mueller to be in the course of this investigation?
Well, I don't think that it signals the end of Mueller's investigation, but I do think it signals that we're closer to the end than to the beginning. This is what prosecutors might traditionally call a speaking indictment. It's got lots and lots of detail in it. And especially because it seems highly unlikely that Mueller ever expects to try these individuals in a court of law. This is sort of in the function of both an indictment for criminal charges and a report to the American public that is akin to a final report, which is why I say it's closer to the end than it is to the beginning.
Matt Tate, you look skeptical.
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical just because there's a lot of things that aren't in this indictment. So, for instance, this tells us a lot about this internet research agency. It doesn't tell us anything about the people that they were interacting with inside the Trump campaign. It doesn't tell us anything about the intelligence agencies inside Russia itself. It's this, basically the whole of the Russian operation, excluding what actually happened inside their intelligence agencies. So it's, to the extent that it is a report, is very much a partial report.
Paul, are you, David described the document at the outset of this conversation as, at one level, he kind of knew that, you know, he repetitive of what we already knew, and at another level, bracing and stunning. And I'm interested in your reaction on reading it. What is this a situation where you say, yeah, we knew there was a Russian operation to influence the U.S. election, this is what we kind of already knew? Or do you react to this as this is putting on the record some pretty substantial and some pretty important stuff?
Well, I'm much more in the latter camp. If you accept kind of my view, and I hear the contrary view, but if you accept my view that this is never going to get tried, you could almost call it Mueller's call to arms. Even though the intelligence community has long asserted this Russian interference, they've been constrained and unable to give us a detailed accounting of exactly what they know and how they know. Now we have that. So anybody who continues to voice skepticism about Russian efforts to meddle in the election after this is really now not facing merely a conclusory report by the IC, but a substantive report out of the special counsel's office that pretty much damns as credulous anybody who disagrees with it. So this is, in many ways, I think, a call to arms to the American public and to the government. What is most troubling, of course, is that we have yet to respond substantially to this to this story. And if we don't now, it will be far worse.
Matt, I want to talk to you about some of the elements, the narrative elements that are not in here, which you've spent some time today kind of teasing through. You point out that it is not only leaving aside the U.S. side of whatever collusion may have taken place, that it's only focused on the Russian stuff, but it actually doesn't deal at all with anything going on in the Russian government. It's sort of, this is the operation in the Russian private sector, with the caveat, including the president of Russia's favorite catering company. But it's not, you know, what's going on in the FSB or the GRU or in Putin's office itself. Yet you've pointed out to me, and I'd love you to walk through some of this, that how this interacts with our larger sense of the timeline of L'Affaire Russe and, you know, what's going on that's not on the pages of the indictment the same time that those allegations are supposedly taking place. So, you know, take a little stroll down the subtext of the indictment for us.
Sure. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's not actually on the paper, but it's sort of heavily implied by either the dates of things that were going on, some of the individuals involved. So I just checked, Prigozhin was added to the sanctions list actually middle of last year for his involvement with the Ukrainian conflict. So he's sort of known as Putin's chef, but he's not some personal chef. He has massive business contracts with the Ministry of Defense in Russia for catering with massive backhanders off the back of that. He's a billionaire in his own right, a close friend of Vladimir Putin, and clearly having close relationship with the Ministry of Defense means that you know, GRU is Russian military intelligence. They're part of the Ministry of Defense, so that's a fairly logical connection as to why that contract might have looked like it came through him rather than coming directly perhaps through the Ministry of Defense, which is quite interesting. When we look at some of the dates that are involved, we see, for instance, that this company sort of begins its interest in interfering with the US election at about the same time as the Ukrainian Maidan, or very shortly afterwards. We see, for instance, that they have a couple
And just to be clear why that's significant, Putin regarded the Maidan as a U.S. operation.
He publicly said that.
And so the implication here is that the Maidan happens and then all of a sudden there's this sudden operation to interfere in the U.S. election in a kind of reciprocal fashion in Putin's view.
Yes, and bearing in mind that at the time of that, the Secretary of State in the United States was a certain Hillary Clinton as well. And also we see that there's a number of quite distinct stages, at least according to the indictment, as to what was going on. So they sort of begin with a planning stage where they spend, a significant number of months planning their operation. Then they begin this sort of broadly social media exercise of setting up lots of sock puppet accounts on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. But it then starts to become much more aggressive in about April 2016. And one of the things that's really interesting is that in the indictment, they say the first adverts for this happen on April the 6th. This is 3 days after the Panama Papers leak began. It's actually the same day that Vladimir Putin was personally implicated in the Panama Papers. We know at about the same time, actually a couple of weeks before, that the John Podesta phishing email was sent out, that people like Jake Sullivan, who was Hillary Clinton's national security advisor, was targeted. We know about a week or so later that DCLeaks.com was registered, which then became one of the sort of initial distributors of hacked documents by APT28. And we see that the banking records fraud that happened, where they started setting up PayPal accounts, they started setting up fictitious bank accounts with US banks based on deceased individuals' social security numbers and records, which is the final count of the indictment. This begins the day before it becomes public that the DNC network itself had been breached. And of course, this was after the DNC network had been cleaned, because CrowdStrike obviously had cleaned it before the Washington Post comes out with all of this information alleging that Russia had hacked their network. So you can start to see that there's a lot of linkages here, and some of them might be coincidental, but there's a lot of these links here.
So David and Paul, I'm interested in your sense of the interactions that Matt just described between what's in the indictment and what's going on in the rest of the timeline that we're aware of. Is this, I assume we should not read this document in isolation from the other stuff that we know, but I'm also, cognizant of the fact that this is not an indictment about email hacking. It's not an indictment about leaks to WikiLeaks. So, how do you read the aspects of what we know to be the operation that are not listed in here and not discussed in here?
Well, for me, I think it's a little bit why I think I find myself a little more in Matt's camp than in Paul's as to whether this is the beginning of the end rather than the end of the beginning. I think there are so many other pieces to this puzzle, and that this indictment is very surgical in not addressing any of those. It is, full on this influence and covert action campaign, but it really doesn't try to talk about other aspects that have been talked about publicly. I don't know what, if anything, Mueller is doing on any of those other aspects, but I would be surprised if he doesn't have more to say on them in one form or another before we're done. As to how they all fit, Matt is a very keen observer, and he's connecting dots very, very smartly, better than I could do, certainly. But I think it's very hard to know, and I think we have to wait and see what Mueller does and let him do his work. But that's part of why I really think there are more pieces of this puzzle still to come.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, I guess I'm sort of where David is. The indictment is very careful not to make any allegations regarding the Trump campaign. At one point, it actually refers to them as unwitting, which is, pretty exculpatory. I think Matt's drawing of connections is persuasive. If you want to be persuaded, it's the type of thing that an analyst would do in drawing dots and making connections for inference's sake. It's a long way from proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And Mueller has shown himself to be an extremely careful prosecutor. So I think at this point it's really too early to tell. Matt's connections are very suggestive, and they persuade me, but I was persuaded before the indictment. I think it really, though, it's incumbent upon people reading this indictment not to overreach and make that jump to Trump. It's bad enough that we now have all of this detail of the Russian interference in the election in such painful detail and with such obvious knowledge of our culture, that it really is incumbent upon the government and the American people to react in some way, to respond. If we can't take this on board and now go forward and do something to make it better for 2018 and 2020, then shame on us, irrespective of Trump's involvement in this.
I think this indictment is a good illustration of, again, something we probably knew in the abstract, which is that our adversaries here, Russia, China, other more totalitarian governments, I think they think that this is exploiting a fundamental weakness of our democracy, that our very proud marketplace of ideas is so easily flooded with counterfeit gray goods, and to the great detriment of our political discussions and political systems. I really think they have got their finger on a basic weakness of open societies and democracies, and they are going to press on this as hard as they can for as long as they can. And it's incumbent on us, perhaps to respond in the more concrete way that, that Paul, I think, may have in mind. What President Obama did towards the end of his administration was so mild, in my view, as to effectively amount to an implicit, almost an encouragement to please do it again, because it was such a mild response. But I think in some ways, almost more importantly, we have got to evolve as a society, culturally, legally, otherwise, to develop a better immune system for this new kind of virus that is being introduced into our system here. We've got to be careful out there with information. We also, I think, as Paul was also saying, we don't want to overreact. I mean, you know, it can't be that anybody who's anti-Hillary Clinton is automatically in bed with the Russians. You know, we've got to make room for people to have different views and not overreact, but we've got to be wary for what's out there. And legally, you know, obviously we have limits that we want to adhere to because of the First Amendment. We don't want to give those up, obviously. But I think there is some room here, if you look at this indictment carefully, for some ideas to improve our intelligence gathering. I was concerned about the use of VPNs to conceal location. I've been making that point in different contexts. The use of the dark web to facilitate identity theft. These are the kinds of things that we may be able to focus on without, you know, destroying ourselves or sacrificing our fundamental values. But whatever it is, legally, culturally, we have got to adapt to this new threat so that we can deal with it. Otherwise, we really will be overwhelmed by counterfeit goods in the marketplace of ideas.
So I'm going to return to VPNs and tech stuff in a moment. But before I do, Paul, I just want to follow up on one thing that you said, which was that this document, in some sense, is a report to the American people. And I'm interested in that because you and I have gone back and forth about the question of what kind of report, in fact, Bob Mueller will or should produce. And a very large number of people around the country and in the press are expecting a big document that goes thud on a desk that's going to be called the Mueller Report. And, and people are convinced that there's going to be a Mueller Report and that it's going to answer all our questions. And the implication, you've previously cast doubt on whether that's a wise or appropriate course for Mueller. Your comment today suggests that you think of these indictments as themselves the report. And so I'm interested, you know, at this stage, what are your thoughts on the idea of the Mueller report, either as a public document, a la independent counsel's final report, or as a document to Congress in the form of an impeachment referral?
Well, I remain skeptical that Mueller is going to give us a special counsel, independent counsel report that will land like a thud on people's desk. I don't see it as authorized by law. I see a report to the Deputy Attorney General as required, and he will produce that because that's what the regs require. This report, this indictment, is a more classic kind of grand jury report, if you will, a speaking indictment. It's part of we've seen this before. America uses its prosecutorial system in a name and shame function, much like we did, for example, with the Chinese and their economic activity, stealing economic information using cyber means. We issued a series of indictments that have essentially named and shamed them publicly. They are not as effective as indictments that put people in jail, but they do prove to have some substantial effect on the American psyche, and that's what I think this indictment is going to do, far more than bringing these people to jail. If we see an actual 600-page report from Robert Mueller, I will be very surprised.
All right, one last question. One of the things that really impressed me about this document, which was also true of the Manafort indictment, is just the awesome nature of the forensics that clearly lie behind it. I mean, it is describing an incredible intelligence operation on the part of our people to have obtained a bunch of this information. But it is also, as David pointed out earlier, describing activities on the part of the adversary that are themselves very challenging from an intelligence gathering point of view, that is VPN stuff, dark web stuff. And so I'm interested from each of you, because you all have kind of different orientations on this, who's winning the tech war here? I mean, like they get to use VPNs to come in and conduct an operation like this, but they have no privacy in doing it in an ultimate sense. And they, you know, we can find out. So Matt, who's winning here?
That's a great question. I think on different aspects they're winning, and on other aspects we're winning. So with a lot of this, they're really relying on not getting caught in the first place. So, for instance, in the indictment, they're using US email providers to try and contact various people. And the reason they're doing that is because that allows them to appear as US persons when they're doing that initial communication, assuming that they're not going to get caught. But then, of course, because they're using US providers, it means that once we've eventually discovered that this is going on, we can go to that US provider and say, hey, can you give us access to, you know, the stored emails that are there? And so you sort of have this sort of balancing act. They're making trade-offs up front on the basis that they think that it's going to be more persuasive, it's going to be more operationally effective up front to do that, and they don't think they're going to get caught. But then, of course, once the operation is later exposed, some of the decisions that they've made earlier make it easier for us to understand what's gone on. And that's actually been the case throughout the whole of this affair, that we've been able to see several occasions where they've made operational choices which either were suboptimal or they've made mistakes, and that's allowed us to have significant insight into their operations that they didn't expect us to have.
David, you have been concerned about the operational consequences for some time now to the intelligence community of location spoofing and dark web kind of technologies. Which you mentioned earlier in connection with this, spell that out a little bit. Are we winning or are we losing here?
Yeah, I agree with Matt. It's a great question, hard one to answer. There are those who think, you know, we are fundamentally in a golden age of surveillance, and there are those who think we are going dark or going dim. I wrote a long, boring technical paper called Digital Divergence about how I think both of those things are true in some ways and in some areas. We've got lots of great intelligence collection and advantages going on, brought on by digital network technology. And then in other areas, we've got very, very important challenges that we haven't yet figured out how to manage. With respect to location spoofing through VPN or other technology, you know, our surveillance laws fundamentally are still premised on being able to determine reliably and quickly and at scale the location of a surveillance target. And if you can't do that any longer, then the fundamental legal paradigm that we have been using since the 1970s to govern ourselves, and even after the FISA Amendments Act in 2008, will become more and more unworkable. And I don't think we have a substitute framework close at hand. And I'm not sure that right now the government would be capable of developing such a substitute framework if we needed it. So I am specifically concerned about location-based problems challenging our surveillance paradigms. As to golden age and going dark, generally, I think, you know, both sides have certain aspects of it that are true, and I spent 15 pages going through it in nauseating detail. With respect to this kind of influence campaign, I guess I believe we can develop cultural antibodies and investigative antibodies to this because, as Matt was saying, this is the kind of covert action campaign that's probably most effective if it's only discovered after the fact. If we can find out about it in real time, I believe we will be able to respond to it, if nothing else, by just publicizing it. Our institutions shouldn't be tested the way they're being tested right now, but I think they are resilient, and we will be able to adapt over time to deal with this.
Paul, what do you think? Is this a fundamentally a competing tech problem, or is it fundamentally, as David's last comment suggests, a cultural problem of accepting that a certain amount of this stuff is going to happen, but being resilient to it and savvy to it, and being able to develop a certain degree of immunization from getting flooded with bad information by mal actors?
Can I pick both? I mean, look, the starter point is obvious, which is that the tech right now is such that bad actors have a massive advantage over defenders every day and twice on Sunday, whether it's the impenetrability of the dark web, the ready availability of location spoofing, the proliferation of fraudulent identities, or the ability to generate false information and propagate it at literally the speed of light. All of those are significant technical changes that are, in some sense, just differences in kind from pre-existing conditions. But the differences in kind are so differences in degree are so great that they really do become substantially new paradigms. The second part is like David. I think we need to adapt. My fundamental outlook is probably more pessimistic than David's. I'm not sure that we have that capability. The fundamental premise of the democratic discourse is the rationality of discussion. The enshrined in our idea that truth will win in the end. And I'm just not so sure that that's true. I'm not sure that ever was true, but it certainly is much less true now when we are on the receiving end of, I like gray market goods, I'm going to steal that phrase, of information that just poisons the discussion. So this makes me more concerned rather than less.
On that cheerful note, we are going to have to wrap up. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast, which is, as always, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks today to Matt, to David, to Paul for joining us on short notice, and with apologies for the sound quality of the recorded conference line. Our music, to the extent we have music, which we don't on special editions of the podcast, is always performed by Sophia Yan. And, of course, you should do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. So tweet this episode of it and share it on Facebook and, share it on Pinterest and distribute it through whatever information troll farms you may have access to. Because I think if this episode does not get shared by bots, we will have all failed at life.
Amen.
Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.